Good evening. So we're on chapter, is it 18? Yes, it is. Which is page 307 in this book. Actually, I think it's 17. It is 17, and I've called it 18, isn't that right? It's the one where Subhuti asked the Buddha about setting forth on the Bodhisattva path. At least that's the one that I have the notes for.
Well, I have the notes for chapter 17. So
18 is the next one. What are your notes look like, though? I think it's got the wrong number on it. I think this is 16.
Did you remember we read half? Any wrong red half? We stopped, right?
Yeah, half
and then oh, the Donald and red half.
And then, yeah.
There's no past, present, or future. I don't remember where. I was saying I would, but... Angie, it's just such a...
Isn't that funny? I can just do anything, really.
The reading, I can remember where I started reading, yeah.
Well, I wasn't here.
There you go.
I think we did 17 last time. Because I remember the time before I just read 16 with all those 100,000 million old. And my page was turned to 18.
And clearly 17 needed extra elaboration.
Isn't that funny? So this is about the big body, isn't it? The great body. Well, isn't that odd? Okay, so mysterious, very mysterious. This is yours. Oh, look what I've got. I've got another one here. No, I don't. So, what page are we on? 307. Yeah, this is the one about the eyes.
Yes.
Okay. I think we're on track. I think I've actually got the right notes even, believe it or not. So who would like to read? Thank you.
The Buddha said, Subhuti, what do you think? Does the Tathagata possess a physical eye? Subhuti replied, so he does, Bhagavan. The Tathagata possesses a physical eye. The Buddha said, Subhuti, what do you think? Does the Tathagata possess a divine eye? Subhuti replied, so he does, Bhagavan. The Tathagata possesses a divine eye. The Buddha said, Subhuti, what do you think? Does the Tathagata possess a Prajna eye? Subhuti replied, so he does, Bhagavan. The Tathagata possesses a Prajna eye. The Buddha said, Subhuti, what do you think? Does the Tathagata possess a Dharma eye? Subhuti replied, so he does, Bhagavan. The Tathagata possesses a Dharma eye. The Buddha said, Subhuti, what do you think? Does the Tathagata possess a Buddha eye? Subhuti replied, so he does, Bhagavan. The Tathagata possesses a Buddha eye. The Buddha said, Subhuti, what do you think? As many grains of sand as there are in the great river of the Ganges, does the Tathagata not speak of them as grains of sand? Subhuti replied, so he does, Bhagavan, so he does, Sugata. The Tathagata speaks of them as grains of sand. The Buddha said, what do you think, Subhuti? If there were as many rivers as all the grains of sand in the great river of the Ganges, and as many worlds as there are grains of sand in all those rivers, would there be many worlds? Subhuti replied, so there would, Bhagavan. So there would, Sugata. There would be many worlds. The Buddha said, as many beings as there might be in those worlds, Subhuti, I would know their myriad streams of thought. And how so? Streams of thought, Subhuti, what the Tathagata speaks of as streams of thought are no streams. They are called streams of thought. And how so? Subhuti, a past thought cannot be found, a future thought cannot be found, nor can a present thought be found. Is that the right one?
Must have read it somewhere.
So, in the last chapter, which is what confused me, because in the last chapter, Subhuti asked about, not about the, he said, if someone sets forth on the bodhisattva path, how should they stand? How should they walk? And how should they control their thoughts? So then they talked about comportment. And this one is talking about the first one was talking about the thoughts about being, what are beings and how do we understand what they are, and what is liberation, all these ideas. But now Subhuti is being told about how to be the body. He's asking how to, as he was asking about how to liberate beings, the Buddha introduces the Dharma eye and the Buddha eye. So these are ancient, I'm sure these are very, very ancient ideas that go way back before Buddhism, probably back to the beginning. The physical eye, says Red Pine, is mentioned because they want to make sure that Subhuti understands that the Buddha has a real human eye. That the Buddha isn't some ghost-like, angel-like, heavenly being. The Buddha has a real human eye. And therefore, that the rest of us can acquire the other four eyes. If he started out with a human eye and accomplished the four more eyes, then we too, I would say, already have them and just don't know it. So the physical eye is obstructed because it only sees one side of things. And we know that. We know how our mind works. We're always seeing one side or the other side. And most of our arguments come from meeting someone who has the other side and how we cling to it. So the physical eye is very helpful, but it's not nearly enough. We only see one side of things, and you can feel it's not really about eyes, it's about how the mind works and how important it is to open up the mind to know the way it works. So the second eye is the divine eye, which sees both sides without obstruction, but only as things with names, and not their true appearance. And I always think that's very interesting. I think high art shows things beyond their names, or tries to achieve the divine eye by seeing their true appearance as well as their what we would call their actual appearance. That each thing is actually shining with Buddha nature, and there are some artists who can show that, whether it's a portrait of a person or a thing. There was a famous French artist, I think in the 1700s, Chardin, who was sort of magical in that way. He could show a pot, and it was more than a pot. Some music is that way also. The Prajna eye comes next, and it sees the objects in the realm of formlessness and preserves their essential emptiness. In other words, instead of being carried away by the apparent solidity of things, it can see through to how impermanent and very unsolid, very unfixed every single thing is. So it's a kind of detachment. A warm detachment, I would say. It's easy to think it should be a chilly one, that, oh, we stand back and we're not engaged and we're not attached and so we're not connected. But we're very connected and we're very warm. So the Prajna eye is important to, and the Dharma eye are important to feel how it is that we are connected. The Dharma eye perceives the means to liberate others. So suddenly the Dharma eye is seeing others. And it discerns all the differences and the truth of how provisional everything is. It sees where others are and sees expedient means to help them. So that's the Bodhisattva practice, the Dharma eye. And the Buddha eye sees the middle path between form and emptiness. That's it. Nothing fancy. Not even anything special, really. But this is what Shakyamuni attained on his enlightenment. The middle path between form and emptiness. It's not that he got emptiness and flew off into the never land. It's that he realized how to be in this apparent confusion. That he could see through the solid nature of things into the impermanence and the very fluid and open and changing nature of all things, including oneself and others. So that's what all this I business is all about. And of course, the Tathagata possesses all of these eyes. So the Tathagata can see with a human eye and see both sides of things and see through things. And the nature of beings and how to liberate them by seeing all their differences. And that's important too. It's not what we would think, that we're seeing how everybody is all the same. Not really. It's seeing how different everybody is, how different everything is, and appreciating those differences. Seeing where things are, where others are, where they actually are. And none of us is in the same place. So that Dharma eye is extremely helpful. Red Pine says, in the perfection of wisdom in 25,000 lines, the Buddha says that bodhisattvas who seek to purify their five eyes should cultivate the perfections, especially the perfection of prajna, which is the mother of all perfections and the source of a bodhisattva's five eyes. Once they've cultivated and acquired the five eyes, bodhisattvas realize complete enlightenment. Well, so Chao Ming calls this chapter One Body, One Vision. We call it five eyes or five minds, but it's one body. Wei Neng says, each of the beings in all these lands possesses many different states of mind. And although the number of such states is great, they are all called the deluded mind. Meanwhile, what realizes that the mind is not mind is called mind. This mind is the true mind, the eternal mind, the Buddha mind, the Prajnaparamita mind, the pure enlightened Nirvana mind. That the mind is not mind is called mind. Red Pine said, the only way bodhisattvas can liberate other beings is by making use of the very selfless dharmas by which beings are attached. Thus the Buddha introduces us to the Dharma eye and the Buddha eye. By making use of the very selfless dharmas to which beings are attached. So it's not throwing away what we think we know. It's not throwing away anything. It's just opening up our vision. Sheng Yi says, beings are born from deluded thoughts and are thus themselves delusions. True? Beings are born from deluded thoughts and are thus themselves delusions. But a delusion does not recognize a delusion. Hence, beings do not recognize their deluded thoughts. If beings recognized their deluded thoughts, they would at once be able to leave their delusions and see the real mind, which is the Buddha mind. Only the Buddha knows their myriad thoughts aren't thoughts. It's like the ocean and the myriad waves. The waves don't know they're waves. Only the ocean knows that waves aren't waves. Thich Nhat Hanh uses that metaphor often, that we perceive of this dynamic of which we're such a part, each one as a separate thing, and yet it's we're all water. We're all the same water, even though we can define and distinguish the separate different waves. It's extremely paradoxical, and our minds don't like it very much because it doesn't make the kind of sense that we're used to. But the truth is that if we really go deeply into how we know anything about our life and ourself, we have to see that our self is a made-up thing. It's a delusion, as he said, born from deluded thoughts. We use our thoughts to build up a person for ourself, a being. And this is one of the main teachings in this beautiful document, that what we think of as ourself isn't what we think it is. It's not as fixed, as permanent, as unchanging as we would like to think. It's actually made of different stuff from what we think. So, I wouldn't take the eyes too seriously, except as, I don't know, sort of interesting ideas about how the mind works and where the bodhisattva practice fits in to our understanding about our life and all of life. If the bodhisattva is able to perceive the means by discerning the myriad differences, that itself is an incredible practice. It's instructions on how to be with all things. See the wave and see the ocean both. And seeing that makes it possible to reach more deeply into connection with others, which is what bodhisattvas do. So this is a handout. Thank you. Are there questions? A lot of questions.
So, just what you started saying, I don't know if you could say more, that life or the self is not what we think it is, it's something else. What is that something else, or what are parts of it? Or you said it comes from somewhere else.
It's not a concept. So as soon as we try to nail it down to being something, it slips away. So we can't say what the self is. And the delusion is trying to say what it is. So the best way is just to participate in being without trying to be something in particular. Just be what comes. It's like we work together in partnership with being itself. And so, of course, we get up and we have to be somebody very particular and different from everybody else. But we don't really know what that is. We enact it. And we enact it in conjunction with the whole thing as it's enacting it. We're a part of the whole thing, enacting itself. So we try to identify ourself, which means point to ourself, though we can't see ourself. We'll never see ourself whole, inside or outside. We never will, because we're this aliveness that can't be characterized or kept in one form. It's a constantly changing form. So we can fight against it and become very rigid and have very rigid ideas about who we are and what we're representing and what we'll fight for. And I mean, we've seen a lot of that recently, how easy it is to hold on to a side of something, including one's own ideas about things, and not let go. But the whole point is that that kind of holding on just creates so much suffering for everyone. Endless suffering. Because as we're holding on, everything is changing around us, and we're changing too. And we're holding on tight and saying, "You can't make me. I don't want to. Please, please, stop. Stop the world. I want to get off." But we can't stop the world. It just goes on. It's not what we would like. We'd like to be able to organize it and write the script ourselves, but we can't. And we can't even know who we are really in the way that we would like to be. We turn out to be somebody else so often. It's very strange.
So I want to share something personal. When I was a little girl, I don't know if I've ever said this out loud, maybe I have to you. When I was little, I would have these like situations, times when I felt like, where I'd be like, "Oh my God, like I'm a person."
Yes.
Like this like detachment, like,
yes,
people are looking at me and I'm doing things and I have this life and these are my parents and but I'm not there. I was watching.
Uh-huh.
I mean, is that what you're talking about?
Well, that's one of the revelations that we're aware. We find we wake up to our awareness. That happened to me when I was about 5, I think. I was walking with my friend Christy Hoffman, and I looked at her suddenly and I thought, "I'm not her." And she's not me. Whoa! Isn't that amazing? So, yes, that is the awareness. And it's a curse for us in a way, because we take that awareness as telling us something more than it actually is. We think of it as a permanent thing, and it's not. It's awakeness to what's present. And then we make a story out of it, because we have these wonderful brains that are always spinning stories, especially about ourselves, you know, to make it, shore it up and make the story even more permanent feeling than it really is. Good question. Thank you. I think Ron was first.
The question I have to ask you is a word that in my practice I come back and re-examine, and I'd like for you to tell me what in your practice purification means to you.
Oh, he used it in here, didn't he?
To my West, you know, I'm born in a Western
culture. Yes,
word, I've been encountering that word in our practice for over 30 years, and I keep coming back to it. What is that? What's purification? It's because it's been used in non-religious settings and contexts, and I realize I'm tripping up on it, and I would like some assistance.
Well, I can only tell you what it means to me. I'm sure it means many things to many different Buddhists. But for me, it means clarity. That clarity is what that's one of our biggest abilities, and the one that brings us into alignment. And it doesn't mean that everything gets perfect and there aren't any mistakes anymore. It means everything is clearly seen and taken in the moment. And the moment becomes purified that way, because it's not clouded by all our delusions. Ron?
I think you kind of answered my question. I found this particular chapter a little curious, because he starts out with all the five eyes, going into a lot of detail about that, and then suddenly, okay, now another topic, or all of the grades of Santa the Ganges, and then all of the worlds, and all of the things of this world, and all of the myriad springs of thought from these beings which turn out to be not thought. There's no present thought, there's no past thought. I think you kind of touched on it when you got it to use it. Maybe this is just a more roundabout way of saying. It's all delusion, because
there's none of those.
There's no real thought that's clean.
Yes. Yes.
The way it hangs together is,
it's not very logical.
And then regarding what you said, I found the purification, sometimes I think of the another story about remembering that the mirror, he has to answer the question. And the beginning of the mirror, so there was no mirror. They always use this image of the mirror doesn't have one speck, not one speck, it just exists. Probably somebody had an infinite amount of index. Made it feel clean. So the purity is kind of like, I guess I look at all of the secrets that we talk about, while you're giving a list, you kind of get rid of these illusions, get rid of form, get rid of desires, get rid of attachments, and it is what's left.
It's not but getting rid of, though.
Well, maybe not really getting rid of, just kind of
seeing through.
Not worried about it. And then there's a purity.
Isn't it kind of they're not there?
They're not there, but they are there. You know, you can't get rid of them. And if you do, you become extremely delusional. that's one of the real dangers of this, that you can take it as being, erase it all, and then where are you? You know, and it's not like that at all. No, it's a moment by moment thing.
You know they're there, but you don't get hung up on them or just kind of let them all go. So you're not attached to them. There's nothing to worry about.
Well, but you do, you're living a life, and you're living with others who are living a life. And so this is saying that even though you might get all those eyes, that you still have a human eye and also a bodhisattva eye you can have, which sees others. And so it's not that you divorce yourself from life at all. You take it on more and use the dharma that the delusional dharma you use as a bodhisattva in order to talk to people and be with them. You go along with the delusion, knowing it's a delusion, and live on those terms in order to be with other people and to help them. So nothing gets thrown away. It's just that they become clarified, which is what Wei Neng was talking about. We have our own clarity from the very beginning, but we muddy it up with our own self concerns. So the main thing is to drop our self concern, not throw it away either, because we have to be somebody, but not take it so seriously, and see through our delusions. And we become much more vital and much more alive. It's a much bigger life then. But that's a big thing. So that's why we practice.
If you went to this totally elevated plane where you just sort of hear it and move.
Oh, it's not like that.
Listen to you anyway.
Yeah, there's no...
This person dropped and called people around.
No, it's the other way. You just keep getting muddier and muddier. You're going down, down, down into the mud. That's what it is. So, the heavenly realms, you know, are on this round of suffering that Buddha talked about. And they're not, I mean, they're so happy that they can never get off of this chain that we're in. So aiming for a heavenly realm is a big mistake. And that is not what purity is. So it's much more like maybe living like a lotus. Your feet in the mud and complete knowing about the whole, all the elements that are involved. And it's after 8 o'clock, I'm afraid. Thank you all. This has been interesting.